Welcome to the Head Ballet Podcast. This is the place to come to hear my guests discuss with me, Paul Abbott, their favourite novelty songs. The funny, the weird, the daft and the outright baffling tunes that have been skipping and dancing around in their heads for years. Everybody loves something that could be considered novel, so why not celebrate it? For this Christmas special episode, I'm joined by writer and podcaster Tim Worthington, who you will remember was on the podcast earlier this year extolling the virtues of that withdrawn Bernie Cribbins single, Ringing on the Engine Bell. This time, Tim's taking us back to December of 1964 for a look at a record that you might have asked for as a present if you were a fan of a certain tea time science fiction serial that had been running for about the past year or so on the BBC. You can find out about Tim's podcasts, Looks Unfamiliar and It's Good Except It Sucks, and the details about his books and other writing on his website, timworthington.org. And before we get going, I would simply like to offer this heartfelt Christmas message. It is forbidden to dump bodies into the river.
Look out, there's a monster coming. Look out, there's a monster coming. Look out, there's a monster coming. Look out, there's a monster coming.
So, Tim, picture the scene for me, if you will. It's the 25th of December, 1964, and you've come downstairs and you're rushing to see what records you've been bought for your Christmas box. And you've got I Feel Fine by the Beatles sat there on 45. You've got Downtown by Pet Clark. Maybe you've picked up Walk Tall by Val Dunican, I don't know. But you might have another little 45 RPM, 7-inch record underneath the tree if you're a fan of a certain science fiction-themed television show. What could that be, Tim?
That would be I'm Gonna Spend My Christmas with the Dalek by the Go-Go's. Not the Go-Go's you're thinking of, not Belinda Carlisle's Mob, who might not even have been born when this was recorded, some of them. But it was a record, recorded and released very quickly to cash in on Dalek mania. It did nothing, and later it became held up as like kind of an almost like an embarrassing example of Doctor Who cashing gone too far by people who'd never heard it. And that's what we'll come back to. That's the key point here.
I'm gonna spend my Christmas with the Dalek and hug him underneath the mistletoe. And if he's very nice, I'll feed him sugar spice and hang a Christmas stocking from his big left toe. And when we both get up on Christmas
yeah,
morning.
It's a very interesting little article, and the word Dalek mania is something we'll have to discuss. I mean, facts and figures wise, before we get into the specifics, it comes out on this record label Oriole. It's got its number CB1962. It's got a picture sleeve, which is quite rare for 45s in the UK at the time, I think. So there's a lot going on here that we need to unpick. But I think the first thing we should really tackle is, who were the Go-Go's then?
It's very difficult, to be honest with you, to find out very much about them. They were a semi-professional band from Newcastle who, obviously, like everyone else, they were doing the clubs. They were hoping to break through, to make the big time. And in those days, you know, bands like that were 10 a penny, really. And they didn't really, apart from this single, do very much at all. They went back to the day jobs, as far as anyone can tell. I think Sue Smith, the singer, did keep working in music to an extent, but the trail goes very cold on them very quickly, and it's difficult to find out much about them. So they were a band that were basically discovered by Les Van Dyke, who was one of the big names in pop music throughout the 60s, yeah. Got them in to record this, and they didn't do anything, and that was kind of the end of it for them.
Yeah, well, I found in an article from the Daily Mail on the 12th of December 1964, one of the barely any references you can find on a sort of general search for these things. The article's called Dalek Disc, and it starts with, "Among the Christmas novelty discs, I'm going to spend Christmas with a Dalek is about the best." So, I mean, the Daily Mail liked it, so... But it does say who it is. It says, "The kids will go for it in a big way, and the tune is catchy enough to keep the grown-ups' feet tapping." Then it talks about the band that's on this. Mike Johnson, who's 19, he's a van driver. Alan Cairns and Abe Harris, both 20, are minors. Bill Davison, 22, is a woodwork teacher in a school for handicapped children, a language of the day. Les McClellan, 19, is a sales assistant in a music shop. And 17-year-old Sue Smith works in a tailor's shop. And that's it. And I couldn't find any more about them before this or after this. And like you say, I mean, this is 1964 in the UK in a northern city. There's hundreds of these beat bands, isn't there, out there?
Yeah, I would love to know more about them, because that article, like the other few press mentions of them, makes them sound kind of like squeaky clean, almost like they were window dressing for somebody else's record. But, and you know, the reputation since then has been kind of, oh, they were just, you know, photographed the cover of this record, where admittedly they're pulling like surprised faces at a Dalek, and the record itself, for reasons we'll explain, is performed like a childlike manner. But they seem to have been a proper band. I mean, the B-side gives an indication of that. Apart from anything else, the B-side indicates they were listening to bands like The Pretty Things, and that everyone involved was quite a big fan of Joe Meek, the legendary early 60s producer. And there's clearly more to them than that, but they've gone the way of all those bands in the 60s, where all that's left now is, you know, maybe a couple of acetates and the odd off-air recording of a light programme session and one single, and that's it. And with these, we've only got one single. We don't even have, as far as is known, any acetates of anything else they did.
Yeah, it's definitely a one-off, it seems. The way that the A&R and the production system worked around then, as I'm sure many people will know, is there's a lot more stuff thrown at the wall to see what sticks. You know, it's not always going to be a Beatles at the end of the day, and goodness knows it took them long enough to get the opportunities to record anything. But yeah, lots of times the A&R men would drag a group in, say, play this, try it out, didn't work, right, you're done, one and done type thing. And this as well has got that novelty layer on top about Dalek mania, which I find extraordinary. This is 1964. There's a Dalek story on when this comes out, which is the Dalek invasion of Earth, the second Dalek story. So there's only been one Dalek story before this, but this has led to Dalek mania already?
It went absolutely crazy pretty much after the Daleks. Technically their first appearance, because, you know, at the end of the first episode of, listen everyone, I call it the Daleks, the first story. I know you're going to get emails saying, he called it the Daleks and it is called Beyond the Sun, or, you know, whatever, but I call it the Daleks. You're going to have to live with that. Cliffhanger episode one, you see a Dalek arm sort of rocket into view, pinning Barbara against the wall. They actually appear in episode two, and apparently just overnight, it just exploded. I mean, there was that An Adventure in Space and Time, the Mark Gatiss play from a couple of years ago, about the first couple of years of Doctor Who, where it has people emerging into the street the next day and there are children walking around shouting exterminate. Apparently, it was like that.
Yeah, it must have been an extraordinary time.
And by Christmas 64, they were trying to get everything Dalek-related into the shops. There's even the Dalek snow globe. But there are all kinds of toys like the Rolikins, the Cutter Mastic, the robot action Dalek, which I've always liked because, you know, if robots have an action, it's not what Daleks do.
Yes, true, very true. Clearly, anyone who could make a bit of money thinks, I'll have a go at this. And you've got all those mad things that you see, like the things that people really love, like the Rolikins and those, obviously those dress-up outfits of here and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
Clearly, this chap who is known as, well, we've got Les Van Dyke, but we also have another name on the record sleeve, which is Johnny Wirth. Same person. So clearly he's had an idea. And so Les Van Dyke, who's this?
Les Van Dyke was one of the biggest songwriters of the 60s and into the early 70s, who actually, I mean, he probably wrote, in terms of volume, as many hits, if not more, than Lennon and McCartney did. And that's even accounting for the songs they wrote for other artists. Because he started with, because he was Johnny Wirth, he was just a pop star who signed to Oriole, actually, who decided he'd have a go at writing songs. He wrote a song called What Do You Want for his mate Adam Faith, which was a huge smash around the world. And he just went on from there. You know, he wrote loads for Adam Faith, loads for Edan Kane, Cleo Lane, Herman's Hermit, Freddie the Dreamers, people like that. He wrote loads of film themes from around then because, again, that's something about, you know, the whole concept of this record coming out, which I'm sure we'll come back to, is that the film industry, the British film industry, was bigger then. People, when I say there's more confidence, there's more money confidence. It was just somebody had an idea and they went, yeah, go on, make the film.
Yeah.
You know, it might make money back in the cinema for a couple of weeks. That was as far as people had to think then. And I think obviously it changed when, you know, home media became a thing. But he did loads of film themes, including one for a comedy starring Adam Faith, written by Terry Nation, who created the Daleks, which is where this comes about, really.
Well, I didn't know about this until today when reading your very, very good article in Doctor Who magazine that covers this very topic. What a whopper.
Yeah.
It's the quad poster for it that's reproduced in the magazine has got a very smiley, happy-looking Loch Ness monster. And then our friends like Sidney James, Carol Leslie, guest starring Charles Hawtrey and Spike Milligan. I don't think this has popped up on Talking Pictures TV yet, but it wouldn't surprise me to see it there. So have you seen What a Whopper?
I've never seen it. I'll be honest about that. I really want to see it.
Oh, what a whopper. Whoa, 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 what a whopper. One day you're gonna come a cropper. What a whopper, what a low-down line.
Yeah, but an Adam Faith vehicle, essentially. And like you say, this is the point where the music side meets the story writing side. It's Les Van Dyke and Terry Nation coming together. So there's a connection point there.
There is the thing about, I mean, people have a very negative view of Terry Nation because, you know, he secured the rights of the Daleks pretty much. I think it's fair to say before they took off that, you know, wheels were already in motion to own the rights to what he created in scripts. And that's really because he was well advised by his management. You know, if somebody who'd come up as a jobbing writer, he'd been ripped off a lot. He'd seen other people get ripped off. And it's worth remembering his agent for a long time was Roger Hancock, brother of Tony Hancock.
Right.
Who obviously, I mean, he was fiercely protective of his artists. And part of the reason for that would be that, you know, he'd seen how much his brother had suffered at the hands of the industry. And was obviously putting the interests of his clients first. So Terry Nation had the right to the Daleks nailed down almost from day one. But from the beginning, he was very heavily involved in any spin-offs. You know, he rejected some proposals that were put forward. He suggested others. He did things like the Dalek book was, I can't remember the guy's name, but the writer of it was somebody who worked with him on like BBC Light Programme sketch shows in the 50s. You know, so he remembered his old friends as well. And the problem was that the guy at the BBC, Ray Kuzik, who designed them, you know, because he was BBC staff, a bit like George Martin not getting, you know, I suppose George Martin did all right separately, but he never got a percentage from the Beatles records because he was EMI staff. And it's a bit like that, really. Ray Kuzik wasn't entitled to any money. People have this vision of Terry Nation as this evil, grasping capitalist that stole it all. It's just how it worked.
Yeah, I found another little article about Daleks, not about the record, from, again, similar periods. This is from the 28th of December 1964, again in the Daily Mail, and it's just about how, because Dalek Invasion of Earth would have just finished at this point, and it mentions about the fact that they're going to be a new companion in Maureen O'Brien coming up, and it's a quick chat. It's not even a quick chat, really. It's a couple of quick quotes from Terry Nation, who seems insistent that he wishes that the Daleks would go away at this point. So I took it as a normal job where you take the money and quickly look around for more work, but the BBC has insisted that the Daleks return again. And there's an interesting quote from him, and he says, "The Beatles and pop groups in general have dropped a bit in popularity, and the Daleks seem to have filled the gap." So he's suggesting that the Daleks are, I don't quite get where his view of the Beatles having dropped off by 1964. But
well, he wrote them into the next Dalek story, The Chase, as well. So
yeah, indeed. Yeah.
He didn't think they'd drop that far. But, I mean, there is something in that. He was somebody who did want to do new things. And if you look at, you know, people just think of the Daleks when they think of him. But if you look at as well, I mean, he created the two most obvious things, Survivors and Blake 7. There were a number of things he tried to do, like, he tried to get a Dalek series off the ground in America with a very different format. He did a pilot called Incredible Robert Baldick with Robert Hardy in the early 70s about a Victorian scientist who was trying to disprove superstitions with science, which is fantastic. It's a shame that never went to a series. He tried to launch a series of novels starting with Rebecca's World. He created, co-created MacGyver later on, worked on he was always doing something new, but the Daleks just kept coming back. So I think there's some element of truth in that.
Yeah. And so Les Van Dyke clearly lets him know that he's going to do this Dalek record, because also he wants a bit of publicity stuff by the sounds of it. And obviously you don't just find Daleks lying around, despite the amount of merchandising that there is. I would just say, before we get further in on Les Van Dyke, I was looking again, like you said, he wrote loads of stuff. One thing I've mentioned in a previous episode when we had Shaneen Salmon on, I mentioned a song called Not Too Little, Not Too Much by an artist called Chris Sanford, which was a spin-off for Coronation Street. Mm. And that was a Les Van Dyke production, which actually sounds like an Adam Faith song, but it's but he also wrote stuff for like Bobby Rydell and Bobby V. And he wrote Jack in the Box by Clodagh Rodgers.
He did, yes!
Yes, which makes me just think of the cycling tour episode of Monty Python's Flying Circus. So it's...
I was just about to say that.
Yeah.
This is Clodagh Rodgers.
Oh, wee, Clodagh Rodgers, a Jack in the Box. I'm just a Jack in the Box.
Yes, he wrote so much, it's insane. So the BBC are aware this record's coming out, right? That's the case.
Yes, because obviously he'd been in touch with the Doctor Who production office. He arranged to borrow some Daleks for... Now, get this. The photo call for the press and the recording session for the single took place on, like, not just the same day, the same midday. You know, it's a different world then. It was done and dusted by the afternoon. And again, people have a very strange view because of how long it takes not just to make records now, but to, you know, release them and promote them and tour them and so on. What the work rate was like in the 60s, I always point to... If anyone knows much about Pink Floyd, the original frontman, Syd Barrett, basically, he buckled under the weight of what they were doing, and opinions vary as to whether it was mainly his drug use that fueled it or his underlying mental problems or whatever. But if you look at Pink Floyd's work rate in 1967, you know, when they have the first couple of hits,
yeah,
it's astonishing. Even that famous performance on The Look of the Week on the BBC, which still survives, where... they have an argument with Hans Keller, the classical music critic. They played a live show and been in the studio that day. And then they were on Last Thing at Night on BBC One as well. No wonder he got burnt out. You know, it did just work that much more quickly. But Oriol were a quicker label than most, really.
Oh, yeah. So you better fill us in on Oriol Records, because it's fair to say we haven't really talked about the reception of this disc yet, but I'm going to spend my Christmas with a Dalek doesn't keep Oriol running for much longer anyway. So it's something that's done and dusted by 66. But what was it?
It was a label which apparently went back to the 20s, but it really took off in the 50s when it was before rock and roll. It was with skiffle, where they had the idea of, because, you know, obviously everything from the earliest days of rock and roll on was predicated on stars. You know, Elvis Presley, Cliff Richard. It was about finding somebody, grooming them for stardom, promoting them properly and so on. And Oriol's business model was, well, stuff is happening, stuff is already popular. If we can get people in and out of the studio to do a good record and just put it out, you know, it's not going to take the world by storm. Although some of their singles did. But, you know, we'll make some money out of it. And that worked really well for them for a couple of years. They did things like Freight Train by the Chas McDavid Skiffle Group, which is one of the sort of legendary kind of genre-starting skiffle records. That was one of theirs, The Thief and Dixon and Doc Green. Extraordinary single by Mike and Bernie Winters called Fallout Shelter, which satirises nuclear paranoia, which, you know, nobody knows what that is now, but apparently it caused a bit of controversy at the time.
I've got a fallout shelter, it's 9x9.
Hi-fi set and a jug of wine.
Let the missiles fly from nation to nation.
Party, party time in my radiation station.
They had records by Screaming Lord Sutch,
wow.
Quite a few Merseybeat bands, early mod bands, licensed records from Motown before anyone else in the UK. They also had the sideline in doing... a bit like the Top of the Pops albums ahead of their time, like knock-off covers of current singles that were sold exclusively in Woolworths. And it was a very weird mishmash jamboree of a label, but it seemed to work really well for them until, ironically, it was really when the Beatles started making people take music and kind of long-term prospects more seriously.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there is this idea, again, that, you know, the Beatles were considered a bit here today, gone tomorrow, you know, until a couple of years in. But if you go to the Desert Island Discs archive on the iPlayer and you look for one with Arthur Askey from, I think it's just after Please Please Me, so it's very early on.
Yeah.
And he chooses it and he says that, basically I'm paraphrasing, but he says, normally I hate the pop groups, but I've appeared on the bill a few times with these boys. They're not a pop group, they are entertainers and I think they'll be around for a long time.
Oh, that's interesting.
So even then... they were, you know, they were something different. They kind of changed the industry, and Oriole were kind of not quite going to the wall financially, but they could see the writing on the wall, and CBS were looking for a base of operations in the UK, and they just sold up completely to CBS, their entire office complex, studio, and mastering record pressing plant. And that was that, a couple of months after the single came out.
Right, well, we better get into the meat of the thing now, because we've talked around quite a lot of the stuff here, but we need to talk about the record itself and how it's performed, what the content of it is. Now, I wonder, before we get into it, I wonder if anyone's actually managed to find a canon explanation in Doctor Who for this single, because I'm sure someone's tried.
Oh, I hope so. I bet it's been referenced somewhere in the New Adventure or something. I'm not aware of it, but I would love them to have done so.
Yeah, there's a reason for this Dalek to be spending Christmas with a little girl and her family. So do you want to tell everyone what the story of the song is?
Yeah, basically, it's written because Oriole did this kind of thing all the time. And released, I think, on the same day as this, was Santa Bring Me Ringo by Ray Allen and his pre-Lord Charles puppets Titch and Quackers.
I discovered her, you know. Santa, be Santa. Let my heart go bingo. Just bring me Ringo. I wanna hold his hand.
Oh, it's lovely. That's gonna. That's enough hand holding.
Which is about a girl who wants Ringo Starr for Christmas. This is about a younger girl who wants a Dalek for Christmas. That's it. That's all it is. It's a child saying, "I want a Dalek for Christmas," and possibly because they, you know, wanted to record it quickly. They didn't get a child in to sing it. They got Sue Smith to do a little girl voice about being excited about getting, yeah, I suppose a toy Dalek, you know, like a robot action one maybe. And I think that's what puts people off, because it is sung in quite a cutesy voice.
Yeah, it's got Christmas rather than Christmas. It's very merry Christmas,
Christmas
type
yes.
thing in a little girly voice. Yeah. And it's got that funny little giggle in there.
And when we both get up on Christmas morning, I'll kiss him on his chrome-inflated head and take him in to say hi to Mum and frighten Daddy out of his bed.
And that's before we even get to the Dalek voice itself, which is, you know, this is not the Radiophonic Workshop making this. It's a studio in central London, isn't it? But they don't do bad with the Dalek voice, do they?
No, again, I maintain this is where context is important, because, you know, most people that heard this in the 60s would have been on medium wave radio or on, you know, because it was record for kids mainly. It would have been on a cheap mono record player, maybe one of those ones with a fold down lid, which, you know, never, you know, used to rumble when you played them as well. And it probably would have sounded quite, you know, just about convincing enough. I mean, if there was organised fandom, then there would have been people saying, that's not a correct Dalek voice because blah, 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 blah. But you know, it does the job. And I will say this, Les Van Dyke did the voice.
Right.
He had clearly studied how the Daleks talked in terms of, you know, the flattened vowels and which were elongated and which weren't, because he gets that right. You know, the Merry Christmas is quite accurate, really. Apart from when it just bellows Christmas tree for no reason.
Yeah. Merry Christmas.
Christmas tree.
Happy Christmas.
Mistletoe.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
He does have the added challenge of that he's not saying typical Dalek words and phrases here. He is actually he's a goody Dalek, let's say, because and he's powered, rather than by pure hate, clearly he's powered by plum pudding.
And custard.
And custard, of course.
And he very politely asks for more of it as well.
Yeah, and also he clearly is happy to be with this little girl, because there's the bit in the outro, which is just a repeated chorus, where he's just doing the "I love you, you love me" phrases. It's strangely charming, but it is quite hard. Well, it's not quite hard. It's a bit of a shock to get over that initial sort of delivery of the little girl voices. But I think the other thing is the Peter Gunn theme is clearly an influence.
Yeah, it's almost like he'd invented the manual by the KLF about how to write one-hit single music, bits of, you know, familiar melodies and so on. It's very deliberate Peter Gunn reference.
I wonder if the Peter Gunn theme, which was, I think it was a Duane Eddy cover of it, wasn't it? That was a hit with it. I wonder if that was something they perhaps played in the clubs in Newcastle, because I can imagine it would probably work with this, the sound of the band. It'd be quite interesting to hear them do a, because it's got an organ in it. That's the sort of difference from your guitar combo. It's got the organ sound, haven't they?
Yeah, I think that's probably it. Maybe when it was written, it didn't have that riff in, and, you know, because it was recorded quickly. What riffs can you do, Peter Gunn? Okay, we'll stick that in. And, you know, people recognise that. But it does give it a bit of oomph, a bit of muscle, really. I mean, the whole record itself, if you bypass the vocal, which I don't think is as bad as people make out, but it's quite a dynamic, a tough-sounding record. It's very clearly influenced by Joe Meek, who, again, a lot of his singles ended up on Oriole. But it's got that sound, it's got that fizzing, spacey sound. I mean, I find a suspicious similarity between this record as a whole, the sound of it, and even bits of the melody, and I Lost My Heart at the Fairground by Glenda Collins, which is one of the big cult Joe Meek records, which I think was influential on a certain band we don't talk about anymore from the 80s because the singer has turned into a nasty piece of work, but... that was very much picked up in one of their best known songs, but they're very, very close, and yet one is critically revered and one is treated like a joke even by fans of the programme it's associated with.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Some of Joe Meek's records could be very novelty and, you know, silly in their own way.
Oh, they definitely can. I mean, and even Telstar is, by any measure, it's a novelty record because it's such an out there sound for what it is, but that's a smash hit.
This has got Telstar Noises at the start as well, which is, I think, is entirely deliberate.
Yeah, well, actually, that very first article that I mentioned from the Daily Mail on the 12th of December, it says, the song, composed by Johnny Worth, opens with the same atmospheric bleep used by the BBC at the start of each Doctor Who episode. It's like, you've not watched Doctor Who, have you, when you've written this?
No. It's 'cause those... What's this atmospheric bleep? I don't have...
That's what people think of when they think of Doctor Who, that famous bleep sound at the start.
Bleep with a very long scar.
Yeah, oh dear.
I bring you greetings from all Daleks.
But if you flip over this disc, then you get a blues cover, Big Boss Man.
Yes, yeah, which, you know, obviously a lot of bands were doing around that time. This is the reason why I believe the reports that it's them playing on the record, because, you know, the default thing is, oh, it must be session musicians. Session musicians weren't, apart from drummers, weren't that common in those days, really. Unless it was just to back a solo singer. If it was a band, usually, apart from the drummer, you know, the band all played on it. If you listen to that B-side, it's clearly a band that have been doing that song for a while. And the drumming is just about rudimentary enough to convince me that it's not a session man. It's a guy who's been allowed to play the drums in the studio. But that really does pack more of a punch on the A side, I think. I think it's a belting little cover of that song.
Well, you got me working, baby. Working round the clock. I want a drink of water, but you won't let Billy stop. Big Boss Man. Can't you hear me when I call?
The version that sounds closest to organ aside is the one that the Pretty Things had done on the B-side of Rosalind earlier that year.
Right.
Which, you know, they're a pretty wild band to be influenced by, and virtually unknown at that point as well.
Yeah, because I think there's a famous version by Jimmy Reed is the one that people would have, bands like that, like the Pretty Things, would have heard and then made into their own version, I assume. Because that song was originally written by, well, writing credits are an interesting thing with blues-based things, because very rarely do the original writers get any credit. So the Jimmy Reed version's credited to Luther Dixon and Al Smith, who write a lot of great songs. And then the version on this disc, according to the label at least, is credited to Van Dyke. So
that was probably a misprint,
yeah,
I'm guessing.
It's either a misprint or just, you know, the making sure he gets royalties again for that.
Or they might not have known who wrote it. That's,
yeah,
that's possible.
It's entirely,
no, they didn't have the internet at the fingertips in those days.
And yeah, it just rolls along as a fairly chunky little blues rock number. But although I like the way that rather than fade out at the end of that one, they literally just play a chord and it just stops.
Yes! I love that. Again, that's quite... That's quite Joe Meek influenced, I think.
Yeah. It,
with a lot of his records do stop. They actually stop.
It is great the way it ends.
Yeah, Peter. You're just old, there's old.
I think we need to sort of basically say, if in case people haven't guessed, this is not a hit record, is it?
No, absolutely not. And that's where it kind of gets interesting, because it became kind of the punchline of every joke in, you know, Doctor Who magazine, Doctor Who fanzines, Doctor Who fandom in general for a long time. Nobody had heard it because, you know, it wasn't a hit. I don't think that many copies will have been pressed in total compared to something like, say, well, Please Please Me. And as well as that, Oriole used to, I mean, anyone who knows anything about Doctor Who will be chuckling, depressed chuckle at this point, that when their singles are the kind of, you know, run past their commercial value, they used to reuse the tapes. So there was no master tape of this. It couldn't be reissued anywhere. It was very hard to get hold of anything like this because I think it fell into the hands of sort of the sort of collectors who wouldn't play it or would zealously guard it, wouldn't tape it for anyone. It was a long time before I heard it. I think I heard it in, must have been when it was the 30th anniversary Doctor Who celebrations in 1993. A bit of it was played on Radio 1 on Newsbeat.
Oh, right.
When they did a feature about it. I remember jumping up and jamming a C60 in just to get what I could of it. And it was quite a long time before I heard the whole record. I think I didn't hear the full thing. I mean, I looked for it for ages, couldn't find it until it was on a compilation album in 2000, produced by Mark Ayres, who obviously does a lot of Doctor Who-related music stuff called Who Is Doctor Who, where it was all the cash-in and novelty and tie-in records from 63 to 73, the first 10 years. So, you know, you've got members of the cast singing, you've got music from the Dalek films, and you've got this and a couple of other novelty Dalek discs as well. And everything on there is much better than anyone that had ever been led to believe. I mean, even Fraser Hines' song, Who Is Doctor Who, it's an odd record, but it's of a piece with, you know, all those bands in the sort of psychedelic boom who got to do one single and couldn't decide whether to sound like Traffic or be a bit silly and twee and sing about Auntie Mary's button shop. It's that kind of thing. Yeah. And, you know, the way it had been pitched to people, you think it was a nursery rhyme that he fell asleep halfway through. But none of these records were anything like they've been painted to be. And I'm a great champion of all of them. I think people lapse too easily into having an easy thing to kick to show that they understand something much better than everyone else. They are better at liking something. It doesn't work that way. It's like the way I hate the way all of the Star Wars things that I loved having when I was a kid are really disregarded now. You know, people actually tell you, oh, it's been officially decided they're not canon.
No.
Well, they weren't supposed to be canon. It was RTD2C3PO doing a Christmas album saying Merry Christmas to everyone. And I loved it. And so what is wrong with that?
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that there's these Dalek discs exist, you know, not just this one we're talking about, but the ones you say, and then all the Doctor Who spin-offs further than the Daleks as well. I mean, I'm of a mind that, frankly, everyone who appears in Doctor Who as either the lead actor or a companion should be forced to release a single themed around their character. So, so I would have loved to have heard Chameleon's Crazy Christmas or something like that.
I'm sure John Barrowman has done a song about Captain Jack. I mean, I don't dare investigate, but I've never Google for John Barrowman, but I'm sure that must have happened.
Oh, well, you know, I bought this Doctor Who magazine and it comes with a huge poster of John Barrowman on one side of it, so I can have him watch over me while I'm working. So, anyway, this is, yeah, that's, I'm going to spend my Christmas with a Dalek. I mentioned that it's not made with any radiophonic workshop people or anything like that, but something that did pop up on a Christmas theme is something I'd never heard about, but which is a thing called a Christmas commercial, a piece of music just called Christmas Commercial, done by the Radiophonic Workshop, which is really a fascinating little, it's only tiny. Could you tell us a little bit about that, Tim?
Yes, this was from 1963. It was from a BBC Home Service comedy play called The Santa Problem, about a department store in the run-up to Christmas, starring George A. Cooper, who people might not know the name, but they will recognise him if they used to watch Grange Hill at a certain point. He was Mr. Griffiths, the caretaker the curmudgeonly brown coat sporting guy forever ruining Gonch's schemes. He was in Doctor Who as well. He was Cherub in The Smugglers a couple of years after this. But it was kind of a satire on how commercial Christmas was getting. You know, that's 1963. That's when things still shut down, properly shut down over Christmas. People went to carol concerts, they went to see the lights being turned on and so on. And already people were saying it's getting too commercial. And so, to introduce it, John Baker from the Radiophonic Workshop made tape loops of a till being rung up, open, closed and slammed, and fashioned them into, basically, somehow, into a rendition of O Come All Ye Faithful. I have said this a number of times. It turns up on in 1968 on BBC Radiophonic Music, which is a belting album of stuff by him, Delia Derbyshire and David Kane, you know, who were kind of the younger members of the Radiophonic Workshop. It's on that. It is known that Pink Floyd were interested in that. They visited the Radiophonic Workshop. Nick Mason used to go and see White Noise live, who were a band formed by some members of the Radiophonic Workshop. A couple of years later, you've got Money by Pink Floyd has got the cash register as the, you know, the underpinning rhythm of it. People say that was inspired by the Are You Being Served theme. I think it's more likely that we're thinking of this, to be honest.
Yeah, it does a fantastic job through just like this little manipulated, repeated snippet of this cash register sound with the tone in it, which means that they can sort of make it musical. It's an amazing satirical advert, isn't it? It's just for 40 seconds. It's so simple, but it would have taken the time and the effort to know how to vary your tape speed on the copy to get the different pitches and things like that. How to combine to get the rhythms by slicing and sticking tape back together. And like you say, the most obvious thing that feels like is that the next step from it is Pink Floyd's Money.
And also, it is worth saying, it has got a couple of bits where it randomly misses the beat as though the drawer has stuck and has had to be shoved back in, which did used to happen with those old cash registers.
Yeah, Arkwright's till.
Yes, yeah. But that kind of makes it all the more pointed in a way, kind of, as though, you know, it's somebody getting really frustrated with all the people coming in and out of his shop. I mean, I don't know what happened in this play, unfortunately. If it still exists, it's very hard to get hold of. But I'd love to hear it. I'd love to hear that piece of... I say piece of music, I'd love to hear that piece of radiophonic tape splicing in context.
It would be fascinating. Okay, just before we finish then, Tim, I thought we really had to mention, given when you popped on into the Head Ballet earlier, we talked at the end of it about what the theme to Looks Unfamiliar was. And since then, the BBC Motion Graphic Archive has come to light, which is a fantastic little thing. And look what was in there. The book programme 1978 title sequence.
Yes, and it appears to be completely different instruments to what I thought they were from that recording I used to start, Looks Unfamiliar, which has justified my decision to. As I've mentioned before, I've been offered clean copies of it a couple of times, and I've always thought it's got to be that crumbly offer with a bit of the first note missing. It wouldn't really work otherwise. And yeah, it doesn't sound the same, does it? At all.
It does still start very abruptly, which feels like it's got a bit of a funny edit in it, which was a bit odd. But yeah, it's got like it's done to an animation sequence by a guy called Ray Ogden, according to the Motion Graphic Archive, who also did the titles for Captain Zepp, Space Detective, Tenko, and The Great Egg Race.
That's a bit of a varied CV, isn't it?
Yeah, or not tonally similar, those things, really. But if anyone does want to know where Tim's theme for Looks Unfamiliar comes from, you can now actually see it in its original context, which is an interesting thing now. With that mystery at least is solved. Right, well, with all that taken care of, we've dealt with I'm Gonna Spend My Christmas with a Dalek, we've dealt with Les Van Dyke, we've dealt with Terry Nation. There's so much in this, you know, it's amazing what a little piece of plastic can reveal. And so, Tim, thank you for bringing it along onto this Christmas edition, and please now go and enjoy your plum pudding and custard. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. That was only marginally more convincing than the version on the record.
It was great.
I wish to be your friend. Please may I have some more plum pudding?